True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
There was somebody out there that had put cyanide in headache remedies to kill somebody. And one woman said that she had seen that news coverage and she was worried about her husband. They had told her at the time of the autopsy at his death that he had died of emphysema, but she didn't believe it. And she said, "I have a bottle of Excedrin in my house with that same lot number that Sue Snow had. I think you need to come out here and check this out." Out of all of Seattle, all of the bottles out there that had cyanide in them, one woman has two bottles in her house that she says she bought at two different places at two different times. What are the odds of that? Cindy Hamilton was a younger version of her mother in nearly every way. After the polygraph, after Stella came home and told Cindy, "Hey, I failed that polygraph," I think Cindy got scared and realized, you know something, I'm not going down with her. I'm gonna go talk to what I know, and she did. The murder of Bruce Nickel was a perfect crime. I mean, Stella got rid of her husband, no problem. She just didn't get the money she wanted. I guess murder sometimes is a gamble, and Stella threw the dice a second time to try to get that extra cash.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
To say that Stella Nickel had a rough upbringing would be a big understatement. She had a childhood of poverty, neglect, and abuse. At 16, she gave birth to a daughter, Cynthia. And in the next 12 years, she had numerous failed relationships, a failed marriage, and spent some time in jail. In early 1974, she was 32, and she met Bruce Nickel, and they got married. One summer day in 1986, Bruce came home with a headache and took four Excedrin capsules. Stella said that her husband walked out on the back deck and suddenly collapsed. He was taken by helicopter to a Seattle hospital where he died. Doctors said that Bruce died from emphysema, but Stella said that that never made sense. Almost 2 weeks later, Stella heard about the death of a 40-year-old woman named Sue Snow. News reports said that the woman had died after swallowing cyanide-laced Excedrin. Stella immediately called the police to report that Bruce, too, had taken Excedrin right before he died. Police initially focused on Sue Snow's husband, Paul Webb King, for her murder. But the call from Stella Nickel led to the conclusion that Sue Snow was not the only person killed by the poisoned headache medicine. Excedrin capsules were recalled, and an investigation for murders by product tampering began. Join us at the Quiet Inn today for a discussion of the Seattle cyanide murders. There is no doubt that it is a heartless act to kill a spouse, but what kind of a person kills at random? That's really hard to imagine. It's a whole other level, I think.
And we'll talk about it, but she could have gotten away with this.
Yes, another stupid criminal who really dug her own grave.
Yep. Well, we have a nice Washington beer today. It's called Le Morte Bourbon by Black Raven Brewing. And I chose this one just because we had some other Black Raven beers that were sent to us by one of your fans. And I had the Kitty Cat one, blueberry beer or something like that. It was quite nice. But this is by the same company. The beer is a Belgian strong dark ale, 11.2% alcohol by volume.
That is a strong beer.
So I'm sharing.
Good.
It's a dark brown color, kind of hazy, and a little teeny bubbly head, not much. Nice aroma, bourbon, some vanilla, and some dark fruit. Then when you're getting into the taste, and it tastes better as it gets a little warmer, there's some sweet dates, vanilla, and bourbon. And it's a pretty smooth beer, considering it's such a high alcohol by volume. It's very easy to drink, and you kind of forget that it's lying in wait for you.
Well, it sounds kind of multifaceted. I can't wait to taste it.
We'll enjoy it.
All right, let's open it up.
You know, I'm celebrating at the Quiet Inn today.
You are?
I am.
More than usual?
Yes, actually more than usual. I'm so happy they finally got some of the new Founders KBS in. one of my favorite stouts of all time. And this year's is supposed to be very, very good. So I'm looking forward to opening a few of those up.
Okay. What does KBS stand for?
Kentucky Breakfast Stout.
Oh, are these strong beers?
Yes, they're 12 or so percent alcohol.
I think you reviewed one before on one of our episodes, didn't you?
Not for here.
No?
I don't think. I've had it before, certainly, but I don't think we've reviewed it. Maybe we have.
There's so many. It's hard to say, isn't it?
I know.
It's all a blur, isn't
it? Oh, it's just in more ways than one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Why don't you go ahead and start our story?
So in 1946, twins Sue and Sarah Chapman were born. They lived in Denver City, Texas. Now, their father was Chapman. He worked for Continental Oil, and he was universally liked. Their mother, Marion Chapman, had opinions about the way things should be done, and she spoke up regardless of whether her opinion was wanted. So she was a strong-minded person who wasn't afraid to voice her opinion. Sarah always felt that her mother liked Sue best, but Chap showed love to both girls equally. Now, as they were growing up, Sarah and Sue were inseparable. Of course, they had arguments, you know, all sisters do. But as twins, they believed that they were closer to each other than anyone would ever be. And as alike as they seemed at first glance, they were very different women. Sue was the adventurous one who would try anything. Sarah was the cautious one. Where Sue's heart ruled her head, Sarah was the opposite.
And at 16, Sue got pregnant. She ended up marrying the baby's father, Jackie Clayton, and moved on to his farm. Her daughter she named Exa Clayton, and this was in June of 1963. So her parents, Chap and Marion, were disappointed and upset, of course, but Sarah still thought Sue was a very cool girl. Teen pregnancies were not all that uncommon in their class, so Sue wasn't the first popular girl to drop out of school and have a baby. But being stranded out there on the Clayton farm got old pretty quickly. Staying home, cooking and cleaning, caring for Jackie and their baby daughter was not working out for the cute, kind of fun-loving Sue. She did dote on her baby Exa. I mean, she definitely loved her. But she soon decided that Jackie Clayton just wasn't the man of her dreams that she had thought he was. So within months, Sue left Jackie. Sarah, who was always on Sue's side no matter what, was happy when Sue left him. The next man that Sue fell for was Connie Snow, and this was quite a relationship because this was her brother-in-law, who was married to Jackie's sister, if you can follow that.
I got it. So she's ditching Jackie. So what you're saying is that the man that Sue is married to,
Jackie,
his sister Kay's husband, Connie, was Sue's next love interest.
Absolutely. This was a complicated situation, the kind of thing you'd see on a daytime talk show.
Yeah, I'm thinking we should be on Dr. Phil or something.
Right. So Chap and Marion hated the idea of Sue's romance with Connie Snow, and who can blame him? He was also 11 years older than she was.
Wow.
Yeah, so in August of 66, Boeing was recruiting new employees, and Connie took a job with them and left for Seattle to work. Connie started work as a structural mechanic, and Sue moved with her baby just north of Artesia to Roswell, New Mexico, where she took a job being a seamstress for Levi Strauss. Sue was self-conscious about never graduating from high school, but she didn't really let it get in her way. She moved up from the line at Levi to the floor manager. She was very smart, ambitious, and hardworking, but she was still thinking about Connie. They were still communicating, and after some convincing, Sue packed up, and by this time, Exa was 4 years old, and they moved to Seattle to be with Connie. Now, she's only 20. Connie's in his early 30s.
Right. But at the same time, she didn't rush out and marry him right away.
No, her parents asked her to wait, and she respected their wishes.
Yeah, there were several years that elapsed. So probably 20 is marginally better than being a 16-year-old in terms of choosing your life's mate. But anyway.
A little bit, yep.
She made it to 20 and took some time and then moved in with him.
Yes.
So Sue and Connie settled down in a mobile home park in Sumner, which was an easy commute from the Auburn Boeing plant where Connie worked. Then in June 1969, Sue took a job at the Pacific East Valley branch of Puget Sound National Bank. She later told people the reason she took the teller's job was that she figured anybody could do it. But like with her job at Levi Strauss, she was pretty good at doing what she did. And she moved up in ranks in the bank.
She did. I mean, she was young, smart. And over the next few years, she moved to the credit department and then repossessions. She wasn't really thrilled with the repo job because sometimes she'd have to steal cars back for the bank. But she did what she had to do to move up. By then, she'd earned her GED also. But she still regretted that she had never gone to college. She always liked the actress Haley Mills. And this was the actress who played twins in Disney's original The Parent Trap. So when her second daughter was born, she named her Haley. At the time of Haley's birth, Boeing had its worst layoffs in company history. So 2 days after Haley was born in 71, Connie was served notice that he was out of a job. But then he was lucky enough to be reassigned to the paint shop, so he wasn't unemployed. Still, they're short on living space, so they moved into a larger mobile home. And it turned out that Haley was an easygoing baby and toddler. Connie, who loved Exa just as much as his biological daughter Haley, would remember how Exa fought with Sue over the littlest issues. Sue was strict with Exa, but it was only because she wanted to make sure that she didn't make the same mistakes that she had. More than anything, she wanted her daughters to go to college.
And though they were separated by hundreds of miles, Sue and her sister Sarah remained pretty close. They talked on the phone daily. Now, when Sue started making noises that her marriage wasn't working out, Sarah was the first to hear of it. This was even before her husband Connie heard about it.
Yeah, she confided in her sister.
And then when there were other men in Sue's life, Sarah would hear about it. Sarah thought Connie Snow was a wonderful guy, a good husband, a good father. But she still understood her sister's infidelities. Sue was a young and vibrant woman. And since she started having babies at age 16, she felt like she maybe missed out on all the fun.
Yes, I could see that.
Men liked her.
Yeah, she was cute. She was outgoing. And Connie was a bit of a homebody. He came home from work and slept on the couch, so there's nothing wrong with that, but it was boring for Sue.
So, and as the Snow marriage began to fall apart, Sue and her daughters left Seattle and moved back to New Mexico, and they were going to take care of Chap, who at this time had had a stroke, and he was in a rehab facility in Roswell. So Sue enrolled Exa in elementary school and took a job at a Roswell bank.
Yeah, but Sue's heart ruled her head again. This was, I guess, kind of her weakness, falling in love with men. She fell in love with a paraplegic Mexican man who'd been in a water skiing accident, and then almost as quickly as it started, that relationship ended. Sue then told Sarah she was going to marry a man from Puget Sound National Bank. This man kept telling her he was going to leave his wife for her, and she wanted him to, but he never did. He really lied to her a lot. She had thought he loved her.
You know those guys that keep telling you they're going to marry you as soon as they leave their wife?
Yes.
They never do.
No, they don't. Yeah, I think of When Harry Met Sally.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Connie hated Sue at first for what she had done. But they ended up staying pretty close to each other, mostly because of the girls. And because Connie Snow knew he would always love Sue. Sue told Sarah that she felt the same way about Connie. It actually took them 8 years to file for a divorce. And Sue and the girls moved into an apartment in New Mexico, and Exa made what she later claimed was the biggest mistake of her life, introducing her mother to Paul Webking.
But Paul wasn't all that bad. He was a long-haul trucker, and he had a son of his own. He was down by the pool at the Meridian Furs apartment complex when Exa introduced him to her mother, Sue. He wasn't a tall guy, but he did seem big. He had a powerful personality. His hair was kind of a longish, dirty brown, and he developed this ability to express anger. But people who really knew him said that was all for show. He was just overcompensating for his shyness by being very direct. Sue's daughter Exa and Paul's son Damon were both students at the same junior high. Though Sue, a bank manager's secretary, was dating white-collar men at the time, she was intrigued enough by Paul to finally go out with him. And on the surface, Paul and Sue wouldn't seem like a compatible couple, but friends would later say it was easy to see how they really complemented each other. Sue sometimes traveled with Paul on weekend trips. For a while, she continued to date the kind of men who fit the plan she had for her life after Connie. But Paul was the cook and the house cleaner, and he and Haley began to form a close bond. In 1981, Paul moved in with Sue and the girls. Damon, who was 17 at the time, moved in with a friend. And Exa, who didn't like sharing her mother with Paul at all, went off to the University of New Mexico. And then eventually, Paul and Sue got married.
Yeah, and somewhere around that time, they moved back to Washington. So there they are, Paul and Sue, fairly newlywed.
But they've been together for a few years by then.
Yeah.
Off and on, at least.
Off and on.
Yeah.
She just had to realize that that's the guy she wanted.
Yeah, she really had a lot of wild oats to sow.
So just after 6:30 in the morning, on June 11th, 1986, Haley realized that the water in her mother's sink had been running for too long a time. Now, Haley knew her mother's morning routine from hearing her perform it every morning through the bathroom walls. Something was wrong. So Haley went into the bathroom to see what was going on, and she found Sue wearing her zippered purple robe flat on her back on the floor. Her eyes were fixed and focused on the corner of the room. Her head was on the sliding track of the shower door, and her fingers were curled backwards in a very unnatural position.
So Haley's call to 911 came in at 6:43 a.m. that day. Sue was breathing, but she said it wasn't normal breathing. The dispatcher told her to go back to her mother and try to get her to talk, but Sue was not responding. And as she spoke to the dispatcher, the doorbell rang and the fire department arrived. This was at 6:47, so only 4 minutes. Haley directed the men to the bathroom where they found Sue Snow. She was lying on the floor in agonal respiration, which is kind of a gasping, snorting respiration. Sue's eyes were open, fixed, and dilated. The firemen attempted to ventilate her by using a bag mask. They looked through the cabinets for drugs, trying to determine if Sue had overdosed. Haley told them that her mom took Excedrin each morning, and the paramedic asked for the bottle. Haley brought it out of the kitchen, but it was full. Unresponsive, Sue was loaded onto a stretcher for the ride to the landing zone on a runway at Auburn's Municipal Airport, where she was airlifted to a major trauma center. But Sue died later the same day without ever regaining consciousness.
So, of course, she's autopsied. Here's this previously healthy, fairly young woman who just died suddenly.
Right.
The assistant medical examiner, her name was Janet Miller, detected the scent of bitter almonds, which is an odor that's distinctive to cyanide.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I learned that only some people can sense that smell. It's a genetic thing.
It's a dominant trait.
It's interesting.
It is. So then they tested Sue's blood and verified that she had died of acute cyanide poisoning. So investigators examined the contents of her house and found the source of the cyanide, which is the bottle of extra strength Excedrin capsules. Both Snow and Webking had used the morning of Sue's death.
Yeah, Paul would say that he also took Excedrin every morning.
And after testing, 3 capsules out of those that remained in the 60-capsule bottle were found to be laced with cyanide in toxic quantities.
So why don't you just tell us briefly how Sue died? What did cyanide do to her body? Because it was sudden, very sudden.
Well, it happens quickly. Cyanide inhibits an enzyme that's necessary for the production of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which I'm sure we all remember from high school, biology, chemistry, and so on. This is kind of the powerhouse for the cells. So if you can't make ATP, the cells die pretty quickly. And boom, you're dead.
So it really just makes the whole body shut down.
Whole body shuts down. It's pretty catastrophic.
And do you think it's painful?
No. If you ingest stuff, you can have some headache and nausea and dizziness and stuff like that. But you're usually not violently ill. And before you know it, you're dead.
So what about the agonal respirations? What's that? It's just her lungs stop working?
Yeah. Everything's shut down. She's unresponsive. Brain is dying. Her heart's dying, her lungs are dying, all her organs are in the shitter.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that you can purchase that so easily, as they say, because that's an awful poison.
Yeah, it's probably not a pleasant way to die, right?
Well, no, I wouldn't guess.
I mean, even though I guess it's relatively pain-free, it's not a nice thing. You must feel like you're gasping, you can't get a breath.
It might be really miserable. We just don't know, right? Because nobody has told us.
Right.
Well, at first, her husband, Paul Webking, was the primary suspect.
Well, sure.
Paul told investigators that Sue only took capsules, but her sister, Sarah, and her daughter, Haley, insisted that Sue only took tablets. And then it also came to light that Paul had cheated on Sue, and they had some problems in their marriage. But eventually, Paul took a polygraph test, and he passed easily, so he was eliminated as a suspect. And that surprised some of Sue's family, because they really thought it was him. They were kind of tough on him.
They were, well, I mean, he acted guilty.
He did. He did weird things, didn't he?
Yeah, but he was not the culprit.
No, but it's strange that he insisted that she only took capsules when everyone else said she took tablets.
Yeah, well.
Although he's her husband, he probably knew more about it than other people did.
I guess he didn't know as much as he thought he knew.
Well, I mean, he might have been correct about the capsule thing, because that's what she was taking.
Well, yeah, except that he had this bottle of capsules, and they took them kind of together.
Right.
What she had in her purse was a bottle of pills, of Excedrin pills.
That's true. And they could have been out of tablets, or they could have picked up the wrong bottle. Who knows? Right. But it was suspicious that he said that.
It was.
But he was able to clear himself pretty quickly. So that's Sue Snow, the first victim. Now I want to go over this incredible life of Stella Nickel, who's the new prime suspect.
She comes forward to say that her recently deceased husband had also taken extra strength Excedrin, and it turned out to be the same lot number as the Excedrin that killed Sue Snow. But she's not immediately the prime suspect. Let's see how she becomes the prime suspect.
Well, I mean, her life is just crazy. By the time Stella was born, her family had fallen into this horrible pattern of abuse and neglect, so it was generational. And there was quite possibly some molestation as well. Her sister, Georgia May, later claimed that her father sexually abused her from age 6 to 9. And the last fight between their mother and father, that any of the children remembered, resulted in the kind of shock and fear that they had already grown used to. Their dad grabbed a shotgun, and their mother told the kids to run, and they all ran to the neighbors. So Stella was too young to have any memories of her father, which might have been a good thing. Only what her mother thought was important to pass on to her, which were pretty negative things. For over a year after leaving their father, the children were farmed out to family and acquaintances. When their mother felt that it was safe to do so, she got her children back and returned to Oregon, where they moved into a tent house just below a sawmill. So that's rough living.
Isn't it?
And this is way back in the 40s, because these crimes happened in the 80s. In 1948, while their mother and brother were gathering wood for the mill where they both worked, the three little girls were left to build a fire. Mary Bell, who was the second oldest girl, was unaware that a jug that held kerosene for the lanterns and a coffee can holding coal oil had been switched. So she poured what she thought was coal oil, but was actually kerosene, in a small can and carried it to the stove to start a fire for dinner. And there was a big explosion. There was a large blast, and she carried the can back out of the house as fast as she could and threw it on the porch. But as she was throwing the can down, Stella, the youngest, came up on the porch, and it splattered all over her leg. So Joe's working at the mill, and she could hear the screams from up there. So she ran down, tackled Stella, and the left leg of her jeans was totally on fire. There were severe burns. Stella was admitted to a Portland hospital where she had to have skin grafts. So she was there for over 2 months.
Yeah, that's a painful procedure.
Oh, I can't even imagine the pain. Well, burns are terrible anyway.
So here you have this horrific life, and now you've been burned fairly severely.
Well, her life is just full of horror.
Yeah, there's more, as they say.
Yeah, so if you think she's a monster, you can kind of see how she was created, how she became a monster.
Yeah.
Although not everybody would, but it certainly would contribute to the way you turn out.
So after this tragedy, a few years later, there was another house fire. And this time Stella's baby brother Joe was killed.
Yeah, and he was born quite a while after the girls, so he was just a very young baby.
Yeah. So the girls had suffered serious burns, but they were recovering. The little boy was burnt beyond recognition. So according to Stella, they wrapped little baby Joe up in newspapers, and their mother had to drive home with his body on the back seat. And there was no funeral for little Joe. They didn't have the money.
No, they were down and out. And in a life filled with all these unfortunate events, they just kind of seemed to take his death in stride and move on. It's like, well, what else are you going to do, I guess? It's really sad. So Stella definitely grew up very fast. Her older sister, Georgia May, once suggested that Stella was probably sexually active before she even finished grammar school. By the time Stella hit her teens, she was well-developed and she really liked to show it off. Though she began running around with boys, she still dreamed of being a veterinarian, a nurse, or a model. But none of these dreams ever came true for her. At 15, she was pregnant. How it happened and who was the father, though, would be the subject of family discussions over the years. There were different beliefs about this. But Stella's version was that she had been gang raped. She said it happened while she was visiting a boyfriend, and his mother left the two of them alone, and he called a friend over. And when the friend came over, they took her upstairs and raped her. And she got pregnant that way.
Yeah, so she's already 4 months pregnant when she finds out that she actually is pregnant. Then she tried to hide the pregnancy as long as she possibly could. But finally she had to tell her mother. Now her mother's solution was for Stella to marry the baby's father. Stella wanted her baby to have the name of someone better than the biological dad, so she used a young man named Ricky Slauson as the baby's father. He told people actually that the baby was his. So she had the baby in October of 1959 and named her Cynthia. And meanwhile, Stella's running wild, sleeping around for years on end, and she'd leave Cynthia with her mother and sisters off and on.
Yeah, I mean, not surprisingly, she was not a good mother.
Well, she didn't know how.
Right? No, exactly.
And she was only 15.
Yes. Wow. And the only thing she really felt like she had going for her was her sexuality. It's really very sad. She left Ricky while Cynthia was still a baby and moved to Southern California, remarried and had another daughter. Cynthia grew up to be wild and promiscuous, no surprise, like her mom. She had no supervision. I mean, even Stella's mom was not the greatest. She had similar issues. This was going on for generations. Stella would go out and pick up men in bars and leave home for days at a time. And then she'd show up with hundreds of dollars and no explanation for where she got this money. Some of Stella's acquaintances wondered if she was working as a prostitute. And that wouldn't be such a stretch, would it?
No, it wouldn't be a surprise.
Because she dressed kind of like a prostitute, she went to bars, and where else would she earn this money? She rarely worked a real job, and she always had money to buy clothes and jewelry that she wanted. She also got in trouble with the law several times and served 6 months in jail on a fraud charge because she falsified an application to get food stamps. Before leaving her husband, Bob, Stella had numerous affairs as well. So it wasn't uncommon for Bob to wake up during their marriage and find Stella had left the house overnight. It wasn't much of a marriage.
Stella would later blame Bob for the food stamp fraud, and then accused him of molesting her daughters, and the younger one was his own biological daughter. Both daughters denied that this ever happened.
So Bob was just a real patsy for her.
Yeah, he was.
He put up with more than I can imagine anyone putting up with in a relationship.
And then some.
But he was smitten with her. A lot of men were. She did have a way with men.
She did have a way with men. In 1974, Stella met her true love, Bruce Nickel.
Well, that's questionable if that was her true love. It was her next husband.
He lasted until he died.
Yeah, true.
So Bruce was a heavy equipment operator and a heavy alcohol drinker. Now, that was fine with Stella because she liked to hang out in bars and drink. She and Bruce married in 1976. Over the next 10 years of Stella and Bruce's marriage, Bruce entered rehab and stopped drinking altogether. Stella, however, enjoyed the party life, and she resented this change in their lifestyle.
So this is something people who knew Stella talked a lot about, was he drank too much, and she wanted him to cut back, but she didn't really want him to quit. And when he did finally quit, she did want him to go to rehab, but she just didn't like that life once she had it. He was boring. She wasn't going out and getting drunk 3 or 4 times a week with him.
No, he was an old stick in the mud.
Exactly. And she started to resent him, a lot of people think. She began to work evenings at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport as a security screener, and she'd often use that as an excuse to stay out all night doing God knows what. So on June 5th of 86, the couple were living in Auburn, Washington, when Bruce, now 52 years old, came home from work with a headache. According to Stella, he took 4 extra-strength Excedrin capsules from a bottle in their home, and he collapsed minutes later. Bruce died shortly after that at Harborview Medical Center. His death was initially ruled to be by natural causes, with attending physicians identifying the cause of death as emphysema. So he probably had emphysema. He was a heavy smoker. But that wasn't what killed him, we believe. Well, we know now it wasn't.
Yeah, he absolutely was a heavy smoker because drinking and smoking just go together, right?
Usually, yeah.
So it wouldn't be unusual or unheard of that he had some degree of lung damage, emphysema. And then whether or not this actually killed him before they figured out it was the cyanide, I think it's reasonable.
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I think of dying of emphysema, I think of someone who's been on oxygen, they have inhalers, they're seeing the doctor. I mean, it's like a very chronic thing where you go downhill slowly. Well, I've never heard of anyone just collapsing with emphysema and dying.
We don't know how healthy he was in the latter years.
Well, sure. But nobody had said that he was short of breath all the time anything.
That's certainly true.
So I think Stella was right that that didn't make sense.
Well, yeah. But they also didn't have any other reason before they figured out it was the cyanide.
Exactly.
So they see that he does have some emphysema, and they say, well, that must have been what killed him, because we don't have anything else to explain it.
Right. He's a 52-year-old, you know, former alcoholic, heavy smoker, kind of a rough life. You're probably not that surprised that he died, as you would be with Sue Snow, which seemed more of a shock.
Definitely.
But after Sue's death was publicized, Stella came forward, and she told police that her husband had recently died suddenly after taking pills from a 40-capsule bottle of extra-strength Excedrin. And, as you said earlier, it had the same lot number as the one that had killed Sue Snow.
Yeah, so why don't we take a little break here, and then we'll resume the discussion.
Take coloring your hair to the next level with one of my favorite beauty products, Madison Reed Hair Color. For as long as I can remember, there were two options I had for coloring my hair. That's the outdated home color that I'd pick up at the grocery store, or having the considerable financial and time investment of visiting the salon. We're busy women, and you shouldn't have to be rich to have multi-tonal hair coloring that's crafted by the experts. What makes Madison Reed Color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm to create over 45 gorgeous multi-tonal shades to choose from. You deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered right to your door for less than $25. Many Madison Reed clients comment on how their new hair color has improved their lives, and I count myself among these clients. Madison Reed gives me gray covering, game-changing blonde hair that I can maintain at home, looking like I just came from the salon. I thought I was really chained to monthly salon visits for life, and I didn't think I'd ever color my hair at home again, but Madison Reed has liberated me. My hair is shiny and healthy, and I get this quality, nuanced color with the convenience of home delivery. That's why I'm happy to recommend Madison Reed to our listeners. You can join me in finding your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. True Crime Brewery listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with our code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com. Now, Dickie, I know I've asked you what you would do for love before, but what would you do to stay alive? Would you wade through snake-infested water? Would you drink your own urine? Would you cut off your own arm like that hiker did? Because, you know, when the stakes are life and death, we really might be surprised at the lengths we would go to save ourselves. The will to live is very primitive and strong.
It's certainly a thought-provoking question. And each Monday, the Parcast Network's podcast Survival demonstrates the human spirit's ability to triumph over deadly adversity, and it examines the psychological effects of living through a traumatic event. Survival tells high-intensity stories of people in life-or-death situations and does a deep dive into the strategies they use to survive.
This kind of stuff really fascinates me. Survival tells the story of a pilot and passenger crash-landing in the Canadian Yukon in the dead of winter, a man escaping from a North Korean internment camp, and people trapped on sinking ships, and many more.
Survival. How far would you go to stay alive? Search for and subscribe to Survival wherever you listen to Parcast shows. And please, don't forget to rate and review.
Great. So the FDA and the FBI visited Stella that June 19th. Though her friend who spent the evening before with her said she drank half a bottle of gin, Stella seemed refreshed and eager to speak with these investigators. She was wearing a nice pair of jeans and a Western shirt. Her makeup was tastefully done, which it usually wasn't, and her long dark hair was clipped back with a barrette.
FBI agents Ike Nakamoto and Larry Montague and the FDA's Kim Rice arrived at Stella's mobile home around 9:45 in the morning. Stella was calm, and she answered the agents' background questions directly. She told the investigators that on June 5th, her husband had gone to work as usual and returned at 4:10 that afternoon. She was making dinner when he took a shower and came out to watch TV. He took the four Excedrin capsules, went into the den. After he went into the den, Stella saw him walk to the deck, go outside, and then return to the area in front of the couch, where he collapsed. So she immediately called 911. During that time, she said his breathing either stopped or nearly stopped. And after giving this information to the 911 operator, she went back to Bruce and found he was still breathing, although strangely, and that was probably the agonal respirations you were describing with Sue Snow.
Right, yeah.
Then the ambulance arrived. They worked on him, got him to the hospital, but he died there.
Well, Bruce had been suffering from recurring headaches for a couple of months. Stella explained that, and she added that Excedrin was the only pain reliever that he ever took. She said he usually took four, and she kept all medicines in the kitchen cabinet above the sink. So the thing is they were trying to work on her husband. She was bringing up these Excedrin, which seemed weird. They were asking, is he on any medications? And she said, no, but he's on these, and she showed them the Excedrin bottle, almost like she wanted them to look at the Excedrin and find out he had been poisoned. So while she was discussing the two cyanide-laced Excedrin bottles that she'd given to King County Officer Ed Sexton, Stella said that she, too, had taken some of the capsules from that same bottle that had poisoned her husband. My God, can you believe it? She said. I could have taken some cyanide, too. So Stella admitted that she had a difficult time accepting that her husband had died of emphysema. That was the pathologist's initial ruling. She even called the medical examiner's office twice on June 7th and 13th. She called a third time after she heard about Sue Snow's death. Though the investigations were concerned with the source of the poisoned capsules, Kim Rice from the FDA, in particular, wanted to pinpoint where these bottles had been purchased, because this could be a real problem.
This could be like the Chicago Tylenol poisonings.
Exactly.
From years ago.
Right.
Panic.
Yes.
So Stella said it was likely she purchased them on one of her days off from her job at the airport. In all likelihood, she said, the open tainted bottle had been purchased 2 weeks before her husband's death, either at Albertson's North or Johnny's Market. But she couldn't be certain. The unopened bottle, however, had been purchased at Johnny's in Kent a couple of days before Bruce died. And they also talked about Bruce Nickel. At the time of his death, Bruce was a heavy equipment operator for the State Department of Transportation, and he had recently passed a state physical examination in order to become a permanent employee. So as far as Stella knew, Bruce was covered by a single life insurance policy, which was a policy from the state. She went to a desk under her fish tanks and found a statement from the State Employees Insurance Board. Now later, Stella said that her husband had applied for an additional $100,000 of coverage, but since he had not taken a mandated physical or missed an appointment or had been a problem due to delayed delivery by the post office, whatever, he was turned down. The policy read that state employees had $5,000 basic life, $5,000 for accidental death and dismemberment. Now, there was optional coverage available, which included optional life for $25,000, and there was an additional $100,000 for accidental death and dismemberment, which would give a total possible coverage of $135,000. Now, Stella said at this time, though, that she didn't know what the full amount was.
And then tests by the FDA had confirmed the presence of cyanide in Bruce Nickel's remains and in two Excedrin bottles that Stella had turned over to the police. So the investigation is moving forward. Kim Rice asked if Stella had any grocery receipts from May or June that might help them find out where the bottles were actually purchased. Stella wasn't sure, but she and Bruce had saved receipts for their income taxes, so she went to a desk, she pulled out a shoebox, and looked through the receipts. An Albertson's receipt she found included an item for $3.39, which is the same price as the one that was stickered onto the 40-count bottle. And then minutes earlier, Stella had said that she bought the bottle at Johnny's in Kent. So there's an inconsistency here. But the FDA agent didn't mention that to Stella at the time, but she certainly did take note of it.
She noted, yes.
I think you remember pretty easily where you bought something like that.
Yeah, I think you can.
Did I stop at the Walgreens or did I buy that when I bought groceries? I think you usually know.
Definitely.
At least for a while.
Yeah. Now, Stella's daughter Cindy was interviewed, and she said there were no problems within the Nickel marriage. And if there had been any financial worries, those had been behind them for over a year. Her mother loved her stepfather, and as far as she knew, there were no extramarital affairs going on.
But then we have to remember, take that with a grain of salt, because Cindy was wild. Cindy was very promiscuous, she drank a lot, and her and her mom were more like friends than mother-daughter, so I don't know how much you can believe what Cynthia said about that.
Right.
But anyway, drug companies made massive withdrawals of capsule medicines. Daytril and Bufferin were withdrawn by Bristol-Myers, along with the extra-strength Excedrin capsules. On Tuesday, June 24, 1986, FBI agents continued their examination of inventory to ensure the removal of the banned capsules from the shelves. And a bottle of maximum-strength Anacin 3 at a pay-and-save quickly became the subject of interest. It had been found earlier in the day sitting on a can of peanuts, two rows from where it should have been in the pharmacy's over-the-counter medications display. But not only was it in the wrong section, further examination showed that it was in the wrong store. It had been price stickered on the end flap with a red as advertised label that was put over an orange price tag that was not even used at pay and saves. So yeah. Someone had put a new sticker on it.
Someone planted this one. And there's even more. After going through the store inventory, they discovered that the store didn't even carry that size in the first place.
Yeah, so they took that bottle along with the other ones to the lab.
And FBI Special Agent Roger Martz, who is a chemist in the toxicology unit of the Washington, D.C. Forensic Laboratory, had the five tainted bottles of capsules.
Yeah, so that's all they found were five out of all that recall.
One of which was the Anacin, right?
Yes, exactly.
So latent print examiners had come up with only one unknown latent on all the bottles and none on the tainted capsules themselves. So that the tamperer had likely worn gloves. Now it was FBI agent Martz's job to find out where the poison had been manufactured and where it had been sold.
Big job. The information concerning each bottle was recorded in meticulous detail, of course. And bottle number one from Sue Snow's kitchen had no outside wrappings, no box, not even a cap. Now, her family would say that when Sue got a bottle and opened it, she threw the cap away because they didn't have any kids in the house and she didn't like to bother with opening it.
Yeah, it was just easier to open without a cap.
Yeah, that's kind of clever. I never thought to do that. So of the 60 Excedrin capsules that this bottle was made to hold, 56 remained and 9 of those contained cyanide. And of the 9, 4 contained these strange green specks. The second bottle, a 60-count Excedrin, was from Johnny's in Kent. Though in a box, its safety seal around the neck of the bottle had been cut. Of 56 capsules found in that bottle, 4 contained cyanide, and these were also mixed with little green specks. Bottle number 3 was the 40-count Excedrin from Stella Nichols' home. The lip of the bottle had been pared, making it loose. And it contained 7 capsules, 2 with cyanide, and 1 also had that foreign green specky material.
The fourth bottle had a box, but there's no safety seal around the neck of the bottle. And this was the second one turned in by Stella, and like its companion was a 40-count bottle. And in this 40-count bottle, only 35 capsules remained. 4 capsules contained cyanide, and all of them were mottled with these same green specks.
Yeah, that last bottle was the one that was found at Pay and Save.
Yeah, this bottle was in a box, but the box had been re-glued. And as you said, the box had 2 price stickers, one red and the other orange. And the aluminum safety seal on the top of the bottle had been partially removed, as had the polyethylene seal. So there were 50 capsules supposed to be inside, but only 45 remained. And 4 capsules were tainted. All of these had the green material.
Well, another 60-count Excedrin bottle, retrieved from under Stella's bathroom sink when her mobile home was searched, was completely clean, so that one wasn't considered evidence and wasn't taken. So they weren't able to determine the source of the cyanide. But the ones that were tainted were definitely lethal. The capsules averaged 700 milligrams of cyanide. And I think that's like 3 or 4 times the lethal dose.
It's certainly more than enough to do the job.
Yeah. And people are taking 2 to 4 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a heavy dose. Special Agent Martz wasn't the first one to notice the green specks in 17 of the 23 tainted capsules. But of course, it was his job to determine what they were. 15 members of the Auburn Police gathered at their headquarters on June 26th for a daily briefing, and they reviewed what they knew. 5 tainted bottles had been recovered in South King County. 2 people were dead, Sue Snow and Bruce Nickel, but there was no known link between these 2 victims. A psychological profile suggested that the tamperer was a person who lived locally, might visit the stores to check on the sales of the tampered bottles, or might even visit the victims' graves.
And the investigators knew that it was fairly easy to purchase the cyanide.
That surprises me.
Did me too. You know, chemical supply stores sold it. High school chemistry classes used it. So did photographers, and so did jewelers. The FBI did know that the tampering had been done after the bottles had left the manufacturing plant, so the case appeared to be local. Now, initial suspicions had been directed at the manufacturers of the capsules. Both Paul Wepking and Stella Nickel had filed wrongful death lawsuits against Bristol-Myers. The FDA inspected the Morrisville, North Carolina plant, where extra-strength Excedrin lot 5H102 had been packaged, but they found no traces of cyanide.
Well, on June 18th, Bristol-Myers had recalled all Excedrin capsules, pulling them from store shelves and warning customers not to use any that they may have already bought. 2 days later, the company announced a recall of all of their non-prescription capsules. Then on June 27th, Washington State put into effect a 90-day ban on the sale of all non-prescription medication and capsules. So this is becoming a very big deal.
Certainly is. An important lead that was being followed was that the capsules that were poisoned, many of them had flecks of an unknown green substance. So they tested this with mass spectrometry and found that the substance was an algicide commonly used in home aquariums and sold under the brand name Algae Destroyer. No other product used by tropical fish owners had the exact same chemical makeup as this one.
Right, and Stella had fish aquariums. So investigators visited local fish pet stores and found out that Stella was actually a frequent customer at the fish gallery, and the clerk there considered her to be very pleasant. The agents asked if Stella had purchased Algae Destroyer from the store, and the clerk thought about it and said he didn't normally carry it in the store because he preferred stocking liquids. But then he remembered telling Stella that he didn't care for the product when she said liquid Algae didn't work for her, and she wanted Algae Destroyer. Don't worry about it, he remembered her saying. I'll just go next door and get it. But he didn't want to lose a customer, so he put in a special order for her. And there were other people who bought some too, but she was the primary person that he kept it in stock for. He explained that moisture sometimes seeped into the blister-packed tablets, and it hardened them to the point where they were almost insoluble in the fish tanks. So he would tell anybody that bought that product that was packaged that way that the only way to get it to work was to crush it up first. So this was a breakthrough.
This was a huge breakthrough, because investigators felt that they now knew how the green material had been mixed in with the cyanide, by accident. Stella had used a dirty bowl, one that she had used to dissolve the crushed green Algae Destroyer tablets when she put the cyanide into the capsules.
So isn't that something? Just the using a dirty bowl did her in.
Well, they recognized that those green things shouldn't be there.
Right.
And investigated.
Yep.
It's pretty good police work.
And they were probably tiny enough that she didn't even know they were in there.
No. I'm sure she looked at the bowl and said, yeah, it's clean.
Well, the focus of the investigation turned to Stella alone at this point. Detectives uncovered more circumstantial evidence also that was pointing to her. She had actually taken out a total of about $76,000 in insurance coverage on Bruce's life, with the additional payout of $100,000 if his death was accidental. She was also known to have, even before Sue Snow's death, repeatedly disputed the ruling that Bruce had died of natural causes. So why would she do that? It's kind of strange.
But you get more money.
Well, we know that now, but what innocent reason would she have for doing that is what I mean.
Well, the only thing would be was that she didn't think he was sick enough from emphysema to have that be the cause of death.
Yeah, which is kind of believable. But further FBI investigation also showed that Bruce Nichols' signatures on at least two of the insurance policies in his name had actually been forged. So that doesn't look good either.
No, it doesn't.
But Stella felt like she could pass a polygraph.
Which she took in November of 1986 and failed miserably.
Yeah, I think she thought she could fool it.
However, there was no concrete evidence proved that she had purchased or used cyanide.
That's true.
So despite their feeling that Stella had orchestrated the poisonings as either an elaborate cover-up for an insurance-motivated murder of her husband, or as a desperate attempt to force her husband's death to be ruled an accident to increase the insurance payout, they couldn't build a strong enough case to support an arrest.
Well, not until her daughter Cynthia decided to speak with them. And that was in January of 87. By now, of course, Cynthia is an adult. And she approached the police with this information. Now, there was a reward out, which might have been part of the reason she did it. But Stella had spoken to her many times, she said, about wanting to kill Bruce. He was a bore, Stella had told her, who, after he got sober, preferred to stay home and watch TV rather than go out to the bars. Stella, Cynthia claimed, had even told her that she had tried to poison Bruce previously with foxglove, and when that failed, she'd begun doing research at the public library, trying to find other methods. And that's when Stella had decided on cyanide. Cynthia also said that Stella had spoken to her about what the two of them could do with the insurance money after Bruce died. So she knew quite a bit.
She did. And remember, this is not a typical mother-daughter relationship. This was two buddies.
Yeah, two party girls, kind of.
So records from the Auburn Public Library were subpoenaed. The records showed that Stella had checked out several books about poisons. One was Human Poisonings from Native and Cultivated Plants. Another one was called Deadly Harvest.
That Deadly Harvest book has come up in other cases that we've talked about.
It has.
Yeah.
Kind of the Bible.
Yeah, I guess so.
One book was marked as overdue in library records that showed that Stella had borrowed it but never returned it. So the FBI was able to identify Stella's fingerprints on the cyanide-related pages of a number of the books that she had checked out from the library.
So this is very damning.
That's a lot more evidence, isn't it?
Yeah. By that summer, her attorneys had to admit that she was the prime suspect in the tampering case. And in December, Stella was finally indicted by a federal grand jury on 5 counts of product tampering, including 2 which resulted in the deaths of Susan Snow and Bruce Nichol. And she was arrested that very day. So Stella went on trial in April of 1988.
In court testimony, Stella's daughter said that her mother had discussed killing Bruce Nichol, and a jury was convinced that she had tampered with the pills and put them back on store shelves, killing her husband and Snow as sort of collateral damage. Then in May 1988, she became the first person in the United States to be convicted of causing death by drug tampering. She was sentenced to 90 years in prison under a federal law that had been created after 7 people died in 1982 in the Chicago area from taking Tylenol laced with cyanide. This crime still is unsolved. Stella was found guilty of all charges after 5 days of jury deliberation. Took them a while, didn't it?
It's a good amount of deliberation.
There must have been a lot of discussion.
But Stella continued to maintain her innocence. She never admitted it. Her lawyers claimed that there was jury tampering and judicial misconduct, and they filed a motion for a mistrial, which was denied. Stella was sentenced to 2 90-year terms for the charges related to the deaths of Sue and Bruce, plus she was given 3 10-year terms for the other product tampering charges. And that's because she could have killed a lot of people.
She sure could have.
She could have killed the whole family.
All these sentences were to run concurrently, and the judge ordered Stella to pay a small fine and to forfeit her remaining assets to the families of her victims. So a second appeal, starting in 2001, was filed by Stella Nichols' new attorney based on evidence obtained by private detectives. He requested a new trial based on new evidence having been discovered that the FBI may have withheld documents from the defense. Now, this appeal was also denied.
But still, Stella and her attorney did continue to say she was innocent, and she claimed that her daughter Cynthia had lied. She said her daughter had lied to get the $300,000 of reward money that was offered. And Cynthia Hamilton did eventually collect $250,000 for testifying against her mom. Which I have kind of a hard time with that, because she could have saved Bruce if she knew all this. And now she's getting paid for coming to the police after the fact?
After the fact.
It's kind of slimy.
Yes, it is, but they might not have been able to charge her without Cynthia's testimony.
Well, I understand, but I feel like Cynthia should have some kind of punishment, but instead she got rewarded, and that's kind of bothersome. Stella also alleged that the evidence actually pointed to another person as the killer, and that the testimony about various smaller details in the case, such as the store owner who testified about her purchasing the algae destroyer, had actually been influenced by promises of payment. So that's a bold thing to say. You're going to say that the FBI was paying off this fish guy?
Right.
I don't think that's very believable.
Well, you're getting into this grand conspiracy theory.
It's like the deep state,
right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Stella is still alive as far as I can tell. I couldn't find anything on her dying recently. She'd be 75, and her first parole hearing was in 2018. She was alive for that. She'll be up for parole again in 2022, I believe. But the frightening thing about Stella to me is that she really didn't care who she killed in order to get away with killing her husband to get money. Like I said, she could have killed a lot of people just by putting those pills in the stores for anyone to purchase. And I don't know how you can not have any conscience about that. I mean, think that a lot of people justify when they're killing one person, like they deserve it or they're in the way. And I mean, they're not correct justifications, but they do find ways to do that. But how do you justify just randomly killing any innocent person who happens to buy these headache medications?
Well, it's not justifiable.
No, it's not.
Except in the mind of the person who's doing it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. How does she justify that in her own mind?
Well, she needs that money.
Well.
And so what if some other people get hurt?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's a cold person.
Very.
She really was a monster. And I think a lot of it was her environment, but there had to be something at the core of her to be able to do that. Another thing I think about is the alcoholism. We did the case of the IHOP waitress, Dee Castile, who had done these horrible murders, which for no real reason that we could figure out, but her mind was addled by alcohol.
Yeah, you never know how much of an issue chronic alcoholism is in terms of your thought processes.
True. Well, as an aside, after the 1982 Tylenol murders, FDA regulations had gone into effect, which made it a federal rather than a state or a local crime to tamper with these products. Local and state authorities are not, however, prevented from also filing charges in these cases. So under this law, Stella's crime was prosecutable as a federal product tampering case, as well as a state murder case. But she was convicted not of murder, but of the product tampering that caused death. So there is a possibility of state charges for the actual murders of Sue Snow and Bruce Nickel, but it's been so long now, that's not likely to happen. She'll likely die in prison. Any comments on that?
No, I think if they were seriously thinking of charging her with murder, state charges, they would have done it long before now.
Right. I think they're just happy that she's not going to get out.
She's been in prison for, what, 30 years now?
Long time. Thank you to Greg Olson for his book, which we read on this case, called Bitter Almonds. And I will include a link to that book in our show notes. If you're interested in this case, there's really some great detail in his book, a lot more than we were able to go into in this hour, about Stella's life, about Sue's life, and Stella's odd behavior after Bruce's death, which we really didn't go into too much. But she acted very strangely to her family and friends. There was the incident with the wedding where she said that she wasn't going to tell these friends that he died until 2 days later because she didn't want to ruin their daughter's wedding.
Right.
Just a lot of weird things like that.
Just stuff that didn't seem that important at the time it happened. But when you look at it in retrospect, you say, yeah, that's weird.
That's not how a widow normally would behave.
Right.
No. Well, the music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. And this is the time in our show when I take a minute to tell listeners about our members-only episodes that we produce exclusively for our Team Tie Grabber members as well as our Patreon supporters. In March, we covered a members-only episode on a guy named Robert Raldan, and Robert was a serial rapist and murderer who started out young doing kind of petty crimes and just gradually worked his way up to being a complete monster. But he was a handsome guy and very charming, reminds me a little bit of Ted Bundy. He really inspired trust from people, which of course he broke in the worst way. For 20 years or so, he caused many women to drop their guard and place themselves in danger with him. We also have over 20 other episodes on our True Crime Premium podcast, and that includes episodes on Diane Downs, a series on the O.J. Simpson cases, Tina Watson, Robert Fisher, who still hasn't been found, and Clara Harris, who drove over her husband with their Mercedes because she found him with his lover at a hotel.
Drove over him more than once.
Backed up and drove over him again.
I try to ignore that.
So if you'd like to give some support to our podcast and get some extra episodes, just go to our website, tygrabber.com, and sign up. Our members also get great gifts, including a snifter or a bottle opener as a thank you from us, because we really do appreciate it. Now, we also always appreciate reviews on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. So if you have a few minutes, we'd love it if you'd do that. We're going to move forward with feedback, and I just want to let you know that you can have your feedback read on our show by sending us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. You can also tell us what's on your mind in your own voice by leaving a voicemail. Just go to our website, and there's a little link on the right side that says leave a voicemail. You click on that, and you've got 3 minutes to tell us what you want to tell us, and then we'll play your voicemail on the show.
Maybe.
If we like it. If it's up to our standards.
Well.
Okay. So let's move on with voicemail. Are you ready for that?
We have two voicemails and two emails. So let's go with Linda for voicemail.
Okay. That's a case suggestion.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Linda. I live in Dallas, Texas. I've actually left you a voicemail in the past. I believe it was back in November. I think I did forget to tell you in my last voicemail that I'm a huge fan of yours, and I encourage anybody who I know to be interested in true crime to please, please, please listen to True Crime Brewery. I thought I'd send you another voicemail today after listening to your podcast called Taking Lives, Dr. Michael Swango. This case brings to mind another case that took place here in Dallas, Texas. The doctor in the Dallas case is Christopher Dunch, spelled D-U-N-T-S-C-H. He was a neurosurgeon who inexplicably made it all the way through medical school, an internship, and a residency in neurosurgery. The first time he was discovered after butchering one of his patients, there was a doctor that was assigned to investigate his work, and the doctor was convinced that he was an imposter. After sending a picture of Dr. Dunch to, I believe it was the hospital where he did the residency, it was confirmed that it was the same Dr. Dunch who did the residency. This is a good sequel, I believe, to the Dr. Swango case. And you can see that the looking the other way, covering for other doctors, not reporting, it's still a thing. You mentioned the national database that's kept on doctors. And this comes up in the Dr. Dunch case where the hospitals were actually checking the database, but there was no information there because it failed. And the reason it failed is hospitals are the reporting agencies for this database. And at least in Dr. Dunch's case, the hospitals did not report, either for legal or political reasons. I'm not sure which. So for research, there's a podcast called Dr. Death. And it's a several-episode podcast covering all the details about Christopher Dunch. And also, there's an article that came out in D Magazine when Dr. Dunch was arrested, and the title of the article was also Dr. Death. I would be highly interested in hearing your back-and-forth discussion on the issues that arise out of Dr. Death, and I'm especially interested in Dick's take on how all of these things happened for Dr. Dunch. And lastly, I just want to thank you for all you do. You are very fun, very interesting to listen to, and I look forward to more podcasts. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Linda. Great voicemail. I appreciate your compliments, and it sounds like a fascinating case. I want to hear what Dick has to say about this community of doctors who stand up for each other, and there's kind of like a mass cover-up going on.
No, there's not a mass cover-up going on.
Okay.
The difficulty is you're always loath to criticize a fellow doctor, as you're loath to criticize a fellow police officer or a fellow attorney or something like that.
Sure, but let's go to the next level of hospitals. They have other reasons.
They do.
They have financial reasons.
They certainly do. And as Linda said, it's not mandated that you report these things to the National Practitioner Data Bank.
Yeah, that's wrong.
So, yeah, it should be. I mean, there are certain things that have to be reported. So, like, malpractice cases are reported. But there's things that can get slipped by.
Well, yeah, it certainly seems that way.
So what you need to do if you're going to make this work is you mandate that all things get reported.
Well, yeah, but there's always going to be things that fall through, aren't there?
Well, no matter what you do, there's going to be cases that do fall through. But if you have to report, that at least eliminates some of them.
Well, sure. That's right. We will look into that because that sounds very interesting, and I would like to discuss that.
Well, I think it'd be a good case. The interesting thing also is that Swango initially wanted to be a neurosurgeon, just like Dr. Dunch.
Yeah, so what's with neurosurgeons?
Yeah, you know.
Although I think neurosurgery is very prestigious. So I could see someone with like power issues wanting to do that.
Well,
maybe not doing it for the right reason.
I think the other part of that is neurosurgeons can have a higher failure rate because they're operating on very difficult cases. So you might be able to do things that can be covered up.
Okay.
Just because of the nature of the surgery. Anyway.
All right. We'll get into that when we do the case. Let's go on to the next voicemail. So I have a voicemail from Marie. Are there two of them?
There are two, but we're only going to play one because the second one is kind of an addendum, and she was teaching us how to pronounce pecan. it's not pecan.
And she doesn't know about me not being able to pronounce things right.
What Marie says in her addendum is that the pecan is what gets stored under the bed. So when you have to go to the bathroom at night, you use the pecan.
Well, I think that's a Midwest thing because I grew up saying pecan. I'm sure everyone in my family always said pecan pie. So I can just say that it's not my fault. I was taught to say it that way.
Well, if you lived in the South, you would pronounce it pecan.
Right. Also in the Midwest, we pronounce crayons as crayons.
Well, we'll go on and on about that. But let's listen to Marie's case suggestion.
Okay, let's go.
Hey, Jill. Hey, Dick. This is Marie. I'm calling from Georgia, which is my home state. And I am traveling with one of my friends, and we have completely become addicted to your podcast and love listening to you guys every week and are devouring every episode we can. And I am desperate for you guys to do the story of the Atlanta child murders that happened around 1979 to 1980, 81, something like that. There were a total of 29 children that were murdered and found in and around the suburbs of Atlanta. 23 of those were African-American children. No one has ever been prosecuted or arrested for those murders and has been proven to be the culprit. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. And the biggest one, which is the saddest one, is that nobody cared because they were black children. So there weren't the funds and the means put towards figuring out who was doing it. There was a man arrested, Wayne Williams, who was linked to it, but it's very doubtful that he had anything to do with it. It's also doubtful that he's actually guilty of the two murders that he is currently serving time for. There's a new documentary coming on the ID channel tonight. I just saw that yesterday, but I'd really like to hear y'all's side of it and hear the medical side of it from Dick's point of view. I always find out some amazing facts that I never knew existed when we listen to you all. So that's it. I don't have any beer recommendations. I'm a pretty generic beer drinker. But we love you guys and love listening and hope to hear that episode. I know it's a big one and it may not even be able to be done in one podcast because there were so many children that went missing or killed. So thanks again and hope y'all have a great weekend.
Well, thank you, Marie. And the audio quality is not great there, Dick, but you must have really liked the content to pass that on to me.
Well, I took into account that she said that she was driving in her friend's car.
Sure.
So it was still totally understandable.
It was. I just don't want to irritate listeners
Just some background noise. But
yeah.
I wanted to bring up that case. I think it'd be a good one to do, the Atlanta child murders.
I think, like she said, though, it would be hard to do in one episode. So I was considering, for our members only, doing another series like we did on OJ. And that might be something that would be a good series of 3 or 4 episodes.
That would be.
So that's something to consider.
Okay.
So yeah, great content. Sorry about the audio. I tried to fix it up the best I could.
It's not bad.
Okay. Thanks, Marie. And I will try and say
pecan.
Pecan. I'll try and say pecan. Okay. So what do we have for emails?
Well, you get the first one. It's from Jan Nicole, and it's a case suggestion.
Okay. Jan Nicole writes, I'm new to podcasts, and I discovered True Crime Brewery last week, and let me tell you, I'm hooked. I listen to at least a few episodes per day, and I love the cool, mellow vibe of your partnership as you retell stories from all my favorite true crime murders. There is a symbiotic and cooperative relationship between the two of you that I deeply enjoy listening to. Thank you very much, Jan Nicole, but Dick, you were supposed to cut that off of the... You're supposed to edit these.
Oh, you can edit it. Just start...
Well, I've already said it now.
Well, you're going to edit it now.
Okay, so she goes on to say, many times I run across a case that I thought I knew everything about, only to be surprised that all of your hard work and research has brought forth new details and even taught me a thing or two. Each day I find myself talking out loud, coming up with theories and questions, making people think I've lost my marbles. Well, yeah, you should be careful about doing that. Sure enough, before the podcast is over, one of you always provides the answers I'm looking for and the reassurance that my theories are correct. I would like to suggest a great case for you to cover along with a yummy beer. You have covered a few cases from my hometown of San Diego, California, and I know Dick loves our huge array of microbreweries. So why not, right? The case is the murder of Chelsea King. This is a very disturbing case with a ton of twists, turns, and a link to the then unsolved murder of Amber Dubois. The murderer, John Gardner, is a twisted soul with a long history of disturbing mental illness. There is a ton of info on the internet, movies, ID shows, as well as court documents available for your researching pleasure. Chelsea's law was even enacted to help make sure crimes like this never happen again. To go along with this horrible case, I'd like to suggest a Southern California brewery that Dick hasn't reviewed yet. It's called BNS Brewing and Distilling Company. Might I suggest the Lawmaker IPA? Fitting considering the text of the podcast. If Dick has any trouble accessing BNS beer, feel free to let me know and I'd be happy to mosey on over to the quiet end of the bar and pick him up a 6-pack or two. Keep up the great work and thanks for all you do. Well, thank you very much, Jan Nicole.
We've heard this story. Gardner murdered these two girls, young teenagers or preteens, somewhere around there.
I remember Amber Dubois' story, yes.
So I think that'd be a good one. We'll look into that.
Okay.
And we will be in Southern California, July, babysitting the grandkids.
That's right.
So I'll look for some BNS brewing.
Okay, great. So we have a case suggestion from Barb. Why don't you read that one?
I'll read this one, and there's nothing laudatory about it, so you won't feel embarrassed when I read it.
Okay, great.
Okay. Barb says, hi, new listener, and so far love the couple episodes I've heard. I scanned the previous titles and don't believe you have done several stories that I would love to hear, and all three are among the most interesting, yet no podcasts or TV shows have told of them that I'm aware of. Now, the first is Lori Dan. She seemingly has the perfect childhood and marriage, but she suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder and clearly had some other mental issues. She ended up attempting to kill many people, including shooting up a grade school, where amazingly only one, which is one too many, but only one died, and then she committed suicide, the shooter. Then the second one, the suggestion is the story of Steven Steinberg, who was acquitted after putting the wife he killed on trial. And the last one is the story of Candy Montgomery, who again got away with the murder of her lover's wife, this while babysitting the couple's daughter. And all three of these have great books associated with them.
And the Candy Montgomery one we know.
We've done that.
We've done an episode on that. What was the name of the episode?
That was Unleashed Rage. It was out in December of 2017.
That was a crazy story. She did get away with murder.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. That is a crazy story.
It is. Well, here's another crazy one. We'll just go from the bottom up.
Okay.
Steven Steinberg killed his wife in 1982. Now, his attorneys claim temporary insanity Ned Steinberg had been sleepwalking when he stabbed his wife, and he was acquitted.
Wow.
So, and they talked about putting the wife on trial, which they certainly did. She was a whiny, demanding woman. And part of the insanity, temporary insanity plea was that her nagging just got to him.
That's outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, we see a lot of that, but not to the point of getting acquitted. Holy shit.
Yeah. So that looks like an interesting story. I just hopefully can find enough info. And then Laurie Dann, she certainly was mentally ill. And she went to an elementary school in 1988 and shot at a group of children. She wounded several kids, killed one. And she escaped from the school, went to a neighboring house, held the family there hostage. After shooting and wounding the son of the family, she killed herself as a SWAT team arrived.
So that's one of those kind of all-over sad cases, and we don't really cover school shootings and things like that. And I feel like the reason is because we're talking about mentally ill people that do something horrible.
She was, and I'm not even touching on all the aspects of her mental illness. This lady was out there.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. It doesn't mean that it's not worth talking about. If we could get into her mental health and how things could have been done differently, how we could handle mental health better, especially in this country, it would be worth having an episode. That's the only direction I could see approaching it from.
Okay.
Okay.
So those are great suggestions. Thank you, Barb.
Yes, thank you, Barb. She came up with 3. That's pretty good.
I know.
But we have great listeners and we always get great recommendations. And we'd like to get more. We're greedy that way. We always want more.
Well, we want more, but I like doing 3 or 4, 5 at a time. So we're not getting too bogged down with them.
Well,
so,
absolutely.
So keep the suggestions coming in, but keep them reasonably small.
What?
Don't say that.
No, I think we just want them to keep coming in is all I'm saying.
Right. Okay. That's true.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for listening. I hope you have a great day and we will see you next time at the Quiet End.
Next week, Quiet End, you and me and a crowd.
Yep. Me and you and a dog named Blue. Isn't that a song?
Sure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.